You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We acknowledge the land we meet on today as the traditional land of the Kaurna people, and we respect their spiritual relationship with country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural heritage and beliefs are still important to the living Kaurna people today. The words come from Charles A. Howe. We light this chalice to affirm that new light is ever waiting to break through to enlighten our ways, that new truth is ever waiting to break through to illumine our minds, and that new love is ever waiting to break through to warm our hearts. May we be open to this light and to the rich possibilities it brings us. I welcome you here today on behalf of the Unitarian Fellowship, which has been worshipping in South Australia since 1854, on Kaurna and Perimak lands. I'm currently the lay leader of this church, and my name is Jenny Dyster. Our services raise to worth ideas that are in accord with our seven principles, which are depicted here on the banner next to the organ. Today, we'll take a look at how we need to temper the free and responsible search for truth with compassion for our kids and ourselves when the facts of the matter are rather harsh and alarming. So the focus is really on our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregation, or in child-friendly language. We believe we should accept one another and keep on learning together. I hope that people can stay after the service for tea, coffee, and conversation. And today we've got a hymn that you may or may not remember because it's a long time since we've done hymn singing. So we'll do all five verses, and it's Comfort Me. Can you remember the title?
Yes.
Good, yes, it's one of the new ones. Now, we've got all adults here, so I'm sure you can remember the ending bit to Pandora's Box. But I think the lead-up is even more fun, really. Well, I mean, Zeus is a total rotter, And if you recall the lead up to this story, you have Epimetheus making lots of little animals out of clay. And the smart beggar, Prometheus, the brother, uses the end of the clay to make people. And he says, well, I'll make mine stand up so they can look around. But he wants a gift, because the other animals have got a gift. I mean, some have got tails, some have got sharp beaks. But Epimetheus has no more clay left to give Prometheus, to give the gift. So Prometheus comes up with a smart idea of giving them fire, which of course sets Zeus right off. He is furious and parks Prometheus on the cliff to have his liver pecked out on a daily basis, restored overnight so it can be pecked out all over again. And you think, well, that's it, that's enough revenge. Oh no, not for Zeus. What Zeus does is that he gives Epimetheus a gift, a woman, absolutely gorgeous. And of course, the other gods are quite keen on this too. So Venus gives her beauty, and Mercury gives her swiftness of thought and good vocabulary and all that sort of stuff. And Epimetheus is, of course, enchanted and marries her. And Zeus gives them a wedding present, the big box, locked, and says, don't open it. Well, you know what's coming, don't you? Why not? Pandora wants to know, because she's not stupid. Never mind why not, just don't touch it. Sort of, that's helpful, isn't it? And so she told herself, well, it's boring, it's probably full of cloth or dishes, butter dishes, something boring. But as she was sitting reading, she heard the little cry, let me out, let me out. Who said that? Do let us out, Pandora. I promised I wouldn't. It's easy, the key's in the lock. You do want to, Pandora, you want to, you know you want to. So, of course, she opens the lid and bang! The lid flies back and she's knocked over by an icy wind full of grit and horrible things. I'm disease, said one. I'm cruelty, said another. I'm pain. She's old age. I'm disappointment. He's hate. I'm jealousy. And that one there is war. And I am death, said the smallest purring voice. The creatures leapt and scuttled and oozed out of the window. Mustering all her strength, Pandora slammed the lid down on the chest, but there was one creature left inside. No, no, Pandora, if you shut me inside, that will be your worst mistake. Let me go. And what's the one left? The butterfly, and it's hope. And that's it. So that's what we want to arouse in the service today. It's now come to that time in the service where we light candles for joy and concern. Please, well, we've got some new people today. It's not for promulgating political beliefs. It's not for convincing each other of our truth. It's for simply expressing events that are spiritually significant in our lives. And we keep it brief because the time for expanding on these ideas is after the service. If somebody says something that attracts your interest, arouses your compassion, you strike up a conversation and get the details. So it's really just the headline, not the whole story. It's okay to light a candle and not say anything. That's another acceptable way of using our little candle ritual. Now, it's time for our reflection, and I will light the first candle today. The last candle is for those concerns that are silent in our hearts. I'm going to talk about anxiety, and this little meditation is to calm anxiety in three steps. Open your attention to the present moment. The invitation is to bring attention to our experience in a wide and more open manner that isn't really involved with selecting or choosing or evaluating, but simply holding, becoming a container for our thoughts, feelings, and sensations of the body that are present, and seeing if we can just watch them instead of inhabiting them from in and feeling them at a deep level. Becoming a spectator to our own minds, watching thoughts from one moment to the next. The second stage is to focus on the breath. Let go of that wide screen and bring a focus that's much more concentrated and centered on breathing in one region of your body. The breath of the belly or the diaphragm. How it is in your chest. Notice the breath going in your nostrils. Cooler on the way in than on the way out. Bring your attention to your body. Become aware of sensations in the body as a whole. Sitting with the whole body, the whole breath. Relaxing tension when we become aware of it. Once again, moving back into a wider and spacious container of attention for our experience. Let the thoughts come and go as they will without fixating on any. Now at home, you'd follow this with a sustained period of silent reflection, which we don't have time for today, but I hope you will enjoy the interlude instead. Today's address is about looking after our kids in a world that seems to be heading for hell in a handcart. COVID is currently the second greatest cause for death in Australia, and so far this year we've lost 4,500 Australians. That compares to 2,500 for the whole of the previous 2 years. Even more dramatic is the war in Ukraine. Civilian losses compare 4,500. But military losses are, of course, much greater. Now, obviously, these issues or events have a negative effect on our own mental well-being, so you could say I'm having a go at two birds with one stone, the kids and ourselves. But let's start with the kids. Before the pandemic, we watched quite upbeat student strikes for climate change. Greta Thunberg making addresses. Our government grizzled about kids being politicised or brainwashed by activists, but those of us who'd done our homework realised 97% of scientists agreed that there are human influences on climate change and 3% who disagree. So we were happy with the interest and the positive action that the kids were showing. And it was mostly fuelled by their own investigations. Not a lot's been taught in schools about the long causes of long-time weather patterns and or anything much about rainfall or ocean currents or wind systems. The last en masse geography student cohort was my dad's generation, who did social studies at school, right? And who did geography? History, yeah, but we're in that mix-over thing, and a lot of us only really did geography at secondary school, not primary. It was social studies until then, and then often it was dropped for the last bit of... So anyway, in the current curriculum, there's a little bit of geography and science, and then it kind of gets lost in humanities and social sciences. Climate change was hot politically, with think tanks set up to explore contradictory evidence, and Bjorn Lomborg was invited to Australia because of his scepticism about the claims made by people promoting the switch from fossil fuels to renewables. Now, Lomborg's not a climate scientist, he's not an economist, he hasn't published peer-reviewed research on environmental or climate policy. He's a statistician and he's a political scientist. His books were aimed at a lay audience and generally minimised the need to cut carbon emissions. Now, what prevented Flinders University, Western Australian University, and the federal government from setting up the means to promulgate his views was stalwart opposition from Australia's academics. They combined and fought it. And a year or two later, the Danish Committee on Scientific Dishonesty concluded in an evaluation of the book that one couldn't prove that Lomborg had been deliberately scientifically dishonest, although he had broken the rules of scientific practice in that he interpreted results beyond the conclusion of the authors he cited. In other words, he got away with talking through the back of his neck, as my grandma would have said, because he was ignorant of the science. Fraud implies knowledge as well as manipulation. Now, this was a huge blow for the "it's not as bad as you think" lobby, but it leaves us with some pretty scary scenarios, which current weather events demonstrate very dramatically. Depending on the age of children you care for, you might consider restricting the news. It's pretty dreadful, isn't it, for a little kid to see a whole house sliding into floodwaters like that. Actually, we can be pretty grateful that we're not watching American news about schools in our neighbourhood and the school shootings, aren't we? The news is pretty awful. I came across an Austrian clip of a middle-aged gent explaining in German to kids where Ukraine was in relation to Austria in response to the very real question from kids: will the war in Ukraine come to us? In Australia, we have a news program produced by the ABC called Behind the News, which is very good at reframing news for children aged 10 to 13. But many items are suitable for children a little younger, and most of them are suitable for those a bit older, like our age. I mean, they're remarkably good, simple explanations, and with background, which is often missing from the news. I remember when I used to read the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Germany, you'd read a story and there'd be Hintergrund, background, and the facts, and then the opinion at the end, and that doesn't happen quite so much here. Now, bearing in mind how scared kids can be by quite commonplace things and how long it can take you to put these in perspective, I'm sure you'll agree that access to 24-hour news is a bad thing, and there's no reason your kids need to view every breaking news alert. If you need to stay connected with updates, the latest sanctions, troop movements, battlefront developments, sneak a peek at your phone before flipping on the TV. But just think, is this keeping us all in a state of high anxiety about events? We don't know how to frame these for ourselves, let alone the kids. So what about older kids? I'm going to tell you about the experience of Professor Julia Steinberger, who was a professor of ecological economics at the University of Lausanne. I'll read what she said. In 2019, I was invited by the first Geneva climate strikers to go around among the high schools on the morning of their very first strike. I went with a friend, racing on our bikes from school to school. That's very European, isn't it, racing on your bike, to as many as we could reach during the morning. And back then, the mood was electric, excited and engaged. The students had taken control of the agenda. They were going to put their concerns and their needs front and centre. They were going to get things moving. There were lots of questions on climate science, projections, impacts, actions. Everyone was excited to take part and to learn. So fast forward 3 years and a pandemic later. The mood could not have been more different. I sensed it as I was speaking. There was a general muttering in this auditorium full of 16 to 17-year-olds. It ebbed a bit, but it never went away. I thought the students might be bored by the specific aspects I was talking about, as sources of emissions, trends, specific impact probabilities, types of mitigation actions. So I raced through all these topics, hoping to reach one that they'd be engaged with. At the end, during the Q&A, it finally came out. One girl took the mic, held onto it. Her questions came through fast and clear and were wildly applauded by her peers. She was clearly channeling the zeitgeist of the room. This is my recollection of some of her questions. Why are you talking to us? We can't do anything. Only politicians, only business leaders can make the big changes you're talking about. Why aren't you talking to them? At the high school, I didn't have time to ask the students what was building up their frustration and betrayal. So in the afternoon, I asked my university students what they thought it might be. And this is the gist of their answers. Teenagers look up to adults. Really? They look up to adults as responsible people who give them guidance and protect them. And they see politicians as the adults of the adults. I'm completely blown away by this expression, she writes. Seeing politicians who know what's going on but acting, and grown-ups around them doing just the same, is deeply upsetting. International agreements, the COP meetings, succeed each other as big shows, big fanfare, but they're empty of substance and change. Then leaders and media turn around and shift the blame onto individuals, as though they were the only ones who could do anything. Everyone knows and no one is acting as though it matters. No one's taking it seriously. Every day on Instagram we see people we know taking flights just for the weekend. Everyone knows, no one cares. Plastic bags all over the place. It's just open hypocrisy. So many brands are jumping on the bandwagon too, coming out with super statements that are just so much greenwashing. And the same for political statements, big public speeches, but then nothing, no action. By contrast, we've seen that with COVID and Russia's war on Ukraine, things can change overnight. But for climate, which is supposed to be a real crisis, nothing is done. The system is bogged down. No one knows how to shift it. In fact, grown-ups identify with the system more than they do with the reality of the climate crisis. These university students wanted to figure out what levers to push to affect change on the intertwined political and economic systems. They wanted to know about legal and commercial aspects of systemic transformation, and above all, they wanted more opportunities of discussing their education and its direction. So, Julia threw away the PowerPoint presentation she had prepared and instead went through the IPCC slides on sectoral solutions, and they discussed each in turn to the extent of her competence. They discussed state capture, industrial lobby groups, vested interests, barriers to change, new technologies and colonialism, and seeing one's work as striving to achieve systemic change. It was one of the best teaching experiences Julia had had. There were smiles and enthusiasm and incredulity and frustrated groans. There was laughter and the whole gamut of human effort, but whatever it was, it didn't feel like betrayal anymore. So what else can we do? Well, one thing is get outside and move. There's nothing like sunlight to help shift a mood. If it's raining, gumboots, umbrellas, rain jackets. Dogs and kids like puddles. If you don't, you have to find another way of keeping the kids moving. The important thing is the break from technology and sedentary pursuits. Dancing or balloon volleyball inside if there's a deluge. Skippy or elastics on the veranda. But for God's sake, get out of the house. The next thing is emphasising what we can control. It can be hard to answer questions from kids when there's so much uncertainty. Will Russia bomb us next? Is this the start of World War III? What's going to happen to the children hiding in the shelters? Those are just a few of the hard questions cast at parents by quite young children. It's all going to be okay is not going to bolster their trust in your grey matter. Focusing on the present moment may be the most honest approach with kids. We can say, today we're safe. We're grateful for what we have. And we're going to do something fun this weekend. Should we take a walk? Where should we go? You can engage older children who may be ready for more mature conversation about world events. Children in middle school and high school may be more ready to delve into the history of conflict and to discuss factors that lead up to it. Finding reliable news sources that will present information that's unbiased and without a political bent is valuable for keeping those conversations informative. It's important to get kids to distinguish between news and commentary. In reputable publications, the label commentary is on the page. But I must confess to not taking too much notice of that until I edited the National Press for VA Radio, which I do every fortnight. The editorials are a mandatory read, but one can consign Andrew Bolt, Janet Albrechtson and Dennis Shanahan to the bin if the article is magically labelled commentary. Academic sources can be valuable learning tools. Catherine David, who's Assistant Professor of Eastern European Studies at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, recently authored an article for the Conversations Curious Kids series that presents the complicated dynamics in plain language. Her article, Why Did Russia Invade Ukraine?, is an easy-to-understand primer for kids of all ages. And I've been reading the conversation for years and I didn't realise they did a kids' version. But you can actually just Google it, the conversation for kids. The Conversation Curious Kids is what it's called, and it's got some fabulous articles. Another thing you can do is find a community to share suggestions. Our Sunday Club is one such group, ideally placed for the exchange of experience and anecdotes and suggestions. But any group with assorted parents and grandparents can work. Sporting groups, gardening, book groups, but generally groups where you're watching the kids and have time to chat are the best. The next thing is recognising when it's all become too much. The invasion of Ukraine is an example of compound drama for many. In Queensland, for example, a pandemic, floods and economic hardships have plagued families for months. Families lost jobs and went through a lot of financial strain during the pandemic. Gas and electricity prices are climbing now. I think it was $2.22 a litre today. I spent 40 cents a litre less than that yesterday. Grocery bills are higher because of inflation. Families are still under a lot of financial strain and kids are feeding off this multitude of stuff that keeps coming and coming and coming without a break. Validating concerns to children who may be worried about Russia and Ukraine is a helpful way to show your listening and compassion. It can be easy to dismiss a concern as silly, look, it's the other side of the world. But addressing a child's worry is a cue for parents to sit down and pause and listen and talk to the child about what they're feeling. It's important not to minimise that, even if they're being overdramatic. That's harmful. We want to give them a moment, ask them to put those feelings into words if they can, but then move into that next stage. These are the things we can control. Let's focus on this today. Well, that's about it. In the absence of magic wands, genies, or gods you can bribe with sacrifices, I've just come up with five suggestions, each of which may help a smidge. The first one was limit your news consumption in front of kids. The next one, outside, get outside and move. Emphasize what we can control. engage older children who may be ready for more mature conversations about world events, get them interested instead of just feeling scared, and finally, find a community to share suggestions. Now for the benediction. Go in peace. Speak truth. Give thanks each day. Respect the earth and all creatures, for they are alive like you. Care for your body. It's a wondrous gift. Live simply. Be of service. Be guided by your faith, not fear. Go lightly on your way. Walk in a sacred manner.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.